Health and Human Services to order on this beautiful day, February 15th, 2008. And I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3616. And I want to call
we have
the dance therapists up.
I don't know if
are there any here.
I have one that, well, I've got the email. We can call this person.
Okay.
Chelsea wasn't available.
Is that 414?
Okay.
I hope that's right.
So what is this about?
She's not available, so she said call Carolyn Johnson.
And I will leave this on record.
That's good.
Make sure. Okay.
Hello?
Hi, Carolyn.
Yeah.
This is Sandy Teeley Circa of the Senate Health and Human Services.
Oh, hi. Hi. How do you do?
Hi. You are on speakerphone in front of the committee, and Chair Monis Anderson will introduce. Yes, we'll speak to you.
Hi, this is Senator Lori Monis Anderson, and we have Senator Avell Gordley, Senator Carter, and Senator Cruz here. And I first want to read this letter before we start asking questions regarding dance therapy. As you know, this is House Bill 3616, and what we don't want to do is pass a bill that has unintended consequences that are truly meeting the mental health needs of individuals in the state of Oregon. This letter is actually from Chelsea Harper, and she says, I am writing because I have been made aware of the impact that House Bill 3616 would have on my profession of dance movement therapy. It is my understanding that art and music therapists have testified in the Senate about the extensive mental health training required for all of the expressive arts therapies. Dance movement therapy is no different, and I'm urging you to include the profession of dance movement therapy. We have a national organization, the American Dance Therapy Association, www.adta.org, with strict educational requirements and professional standards for practice. I have a master's degree in dance movement therapy from Antioch, New England Graduate School, and I provide dance movement therapy services to children and adults in my business, Moving to Balance in Portland, which is www.movingtobalance.com. My graduate degree has been approved by the Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists as equivalent to the educational standards required for state licensure in Oregon. Mm-hmm. I am currently on my maternity leave, and therefore is why she is not able to testify in person, but she appreciates our attention to this important matter, and she gives her phone number with any questions. Evidently, she would not be able to be heard, and so we are calling you. And what I would like you to tell us a little bit about yourself, introduce yourself, and then tell us about therapy and the types of clients and patients that you're actually seeing and their situations. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for allowing us to speak about this. I've been a dance movement therapist for 26 years, and I too have my master's degree from Antioch New England Graduate School in New Hampshire. I am currently working as a group therapist at the Providence Portland Medical Center, the Adult Psychiatric Unit. I've worked there for 11 years. I offer psychotherapy, movement therapy, art therapy, a variety of creative arts therapists. I have been doing that in settings, institutional settings in Massachusetts. I worked at Clinton Hospital. I worked at UMass Medical School. So I have a master's degree. I am a national certified counseling credential. I am not qualified in the state of Oregon for a credential for license, but I was licensed in Massachusetts. So I am a national certified counselor and a master's degree, and I have an ADTR, which is the highest level of excuse of supervision and training as a dance therapist. Now, this is equivalent to a counselor's degree, and as I understand, also a social work degree. We have post-master's degree. We have 2 years of full-time work that we need to accumulate clinical hours and have a certain amount. I think it's a, I don't know an exact number of hours of supervision before we can get the ADTR credential. We are the national organization is currently in the process of establishing a board certification process, which is similar to what the art therapists have. Essentially, we have equivalent the same kind of training at the master's level art, music, and drama therapists. And there are most of us work in hospitals, or some people have private practice. We tend to work with people who are very ill, because the creative arts therapists address the needs of many people who don't have access to verbal skills and verbal expression. So my work, I know, is very much valued at the hospital and has been in all of the settings where I've worked. I have worked with adolescents and adults and children.
Could you just briefly, before I go on, I think for those of us, for those of you who are here for the informational hearing, I apologize for not stating that we do have Dr. Drucker from OHSU, and he does have to leave soon, and so I apologize if we're not able to get you, but we will definitely be having you next week, but hopefully we're going to be able to move along this bill fairly quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. So could you just tell about an individual patient that you treat with movement therapy?
Working in the hospital setting, I am working with pretty severely impaired psychiatric patients, schizophrenic patients, patients with bipolar disorder, patients with severe characterological disorders, and suicidal depression. That's what I'm primarily, any inpatient psych unit works with those patients. It's a short-term setting. And in the past, I've worked with geriatric patients in a geriatric psychiatric unit, geri psych unit, and in a nursing home. So I'm working with very impaired patients, and the arts have a particular ability to engage people in ways that words don't always do alone. So our training is, we are thoroughly trained in counseling and developmental issues, and as a dance therapist, I also am certainly trained to observe I have observational skills of movement, observational nonverbal observational skills. Many of the dance therapists that I work with, I'm a supervisor of many of the students, have worked with children, often with autistic children or children with severe developmental issues. And it's an excellent way to engage children as well.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there any questions? Yes, Senator Carter.
Can you tell me if your educational background includes supervised clinical contact in counseling with clients?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. If the committee would be, if it would be helpful, we could send some curriculum information to the committee about the training. Absolutely. We have a one-year internship that's a part of every program, in addition to a 1 or 2 year classes at a master's level. So it's a supervised clinical internship in a usually a hospital or outpatient setting.
Can you tell me how extensive is your clinical training in assessments, diagnostics, and treatment?
Well, every program has a diagnostic component to it, depending upon the type of patients you're interested in or the focus of it. We do have diagnostic skills and assessment similar to what you might get in a counseling program.
So
learning about tests and measurements and statistics, as well as assessment of not every student would be, I don't know, the programs vary somewhat, but there's always an assessment component in there.
Right, and I'm thinking about, Madam Chair, for the question, I'm thinking about the application of it. Do you actually sit down with students and go over their diagnostic treatment as a part of your training?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And do all the dance therapists have national counselor exam? Do they take that?
They are all eligible to take the National Counselor exam after they receive the ADTR, which is the credential 2 years post-master's.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this raises the issue that there are a number of therapies out there that we don't have a really good handle on, and I know that the House as well as the Senate will want in the future sessions to sort of get a handle on the various therapies and standards and requirements, and looking at the need possibly for Oregon board certification. We need to look at that issue, and that's for you to share with your other dance therapists too, because we want to.
That's an excellent thing. I mean, we're always concerned as well. There are so many people out there calling themselves movement therapists or dance therapists. That's what my concern is. But not everybody has the credentials that we do. So I think the creative, the art, dance, and music therapists have a particular edge in that sense, in that we have very strict educational standards, and so we're not, unfortunately, we're not consistent in our credentialing pattern right now. There's a move to do that. But everybody has a master's and post-master's training and supervision, so it's very comparable to a master's counseling program or a social work program.
Senator Carter.
Just one more question, please. Can you tell me if the number of undergraduate psychology and graduate psychology courses are commensurate with the counseling psych program? Or
I believe they are. Yes, they are.
You believe they are?
I believe they are because we've been working very closely with the National Counseling Organization, with the NCA, establishing alignment. We have we're like a subset of one of the committees in the National Counseling Association, and they have some years ago very carefully looked at the requirements to see if they were equivalent, and they deemed us equivalent both in the educational and practicum requirements.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. There are no further questions, and you can hang up if you want, or if you want to just listen to the rest of the testimony, but it may be quite long.
Yeah, and so you're discussing, can I just ask one question? You're discussing this week, and we'll be voting in the next week?
Yes, we may even vote today. So it just depends, and we do have the amendment to include dance therapists on the docket, but we have several amendments that we are considering today.
Well, thank you very much for hearing me.
All right, thank you.
Yeah.
Goodbye. With that, I'd like to call B.J. Seymour and Barbara Hansen. And Peter, if we need you, we'll call you up, or do you want to come up? Then come on up, too. Yeah.
My name is B.J. Seymour. My address is 1405 Southwest Park Avenue, apartment 34, Portland 97201. You have my testimony in writing. I'm a psychotherapist in private practice. I've specialized in gender identity counseling, gender dysphoria, and related problems since 1987. And as recently as the day before yesterday, I was invited to speak to a local book group as an expert on gender issues. I have held a certificate of qualification for independent practice called ACSW from the Academy of Certified Social Workers, a unit of the National Association of Social Workers, since 1987. I received a master's degree in social work with honors from the University of Chicago in 1962. I was assistant professor of social work at Pacific University, Forest Grove, Oregon, from 1986 through 1990. I've been engaged in the practice of social work for 49 and a half years. House Bill 3616 will require me to become a licensed clinical social worker or give up my practice. To become licensed, I will have to be supervised for 2 years by a licensed clinical social worker. There is no other social worker in Oregon or Southwest Washington who has experience in gender identity counseling comparable to mine. This bill puts me in the position of having to pay someone who knows less about gender identity than I do to supervise me just to comply with the requirements this bill will impose. The next paragraph of my testimony, which you have in hand, explains why I didn't get licensed at the time that licensing came into effect. I was then working for Pacific University as social service director for its optometry clinics. My supervisor was a licensed optometrist. I already had a number of years. I worked 18 years for public welfare, so I had a number of years in social work prior to going to work for the optometry school. And as a matter of fact, when I got out of social work school, I was a volunteer for family counseling service in Salem while working full-time for public welfare. So I had direct clinical experience right after graduate school. There may be other therapists now or in the future who have come to Oregon from other states or countries with different licensing requirements who will be similarly affected. For them, as well as for myself, and especially for clients who stand to benefit from the training and extensive experience of such therapists, I urge that this bill not be passed without an amendment to provide for waiver of supervision requirements in appropriate situations. I'm open to questions.
Questions? Okay, that was the crux of one of the main reasons why this bill came forward, because we have so many people who are saying that they're therapists and we have no way to know, we just don't have a good licensing board structure here in the state for you to be able to then get your license. So any comments on this issue at this point? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Hello, I'm Barbara Hansen, 3710 Southwest Iowa Street, Portland, Oregon, 97221. I'm here to speak as a member of the public. I read about this legislation in the Oregonian, and I got a copy of the House Bill 3616. And I read through it, and I got to page 3, where it says, "Nothing in ORS is intended to limit or prevent the practice of an individual profession or to restrict a person from providing counseling services." And I thought, oh, that's really great, because you can have the licensing board for people who really want to be into the strict requirements and learning statistics and all of those kinds of things. And then you also have people who are not so trained and let the public choose. And as I point out in my testimony, I was a CPA, and we never tried to keep other people from calling themselves accountants. In fact, I've seen excellent work done by accountants, excellent work done by people at H&R Block. I think there's lots of ways to do a good job. And I'm concerned that the way that the educational requirements are getting escalated year after year, while the cost of education is also escalating year after year, I'm afraid that this will keep minorities from getting into the counseling professions. I'm afraid that it is prejudicial against young people as opposed to older people who are like grandfathered in no matter how incompetent they are. So I see how this can be a good deal for licensed therapists, but I don't see how it's a good deal for the public.
And so basically both of your cases are, it would be unrealistic for you to have supervision because there's no one else in the state that it provides, has experience in gender counseling. But you're addressing the same thing, aren't you?
No.
All right.
I'm getting to a basic question of when and how is it appropriate for the state to get involved in licensing professionals. And I think that they need to be able to demonstrate by research that the required preparation is going to pay off in improved service to clients. And I think the burden of proof should be on them.
On the patient?
No.
On the state.
On the licensees. Or the board, let's say.
And I think that the problem that the state is having is we have the industry is proliferating, and we're worried about the safety of individuals, and therefore we need to set some standards so that clients would have a place to complain if there was something happening to them. And so that's, I'm not sure I'm following what you were saying. You're saying,
okay, so if a person has a problem with a CPA, they can complain to the Board of Accountancy. Mm-hmm. But if they have a problem with H&R Block, who do they complain to? That would be a similar. Maybe H&R Block is not a good example because, of course, you can complain to the company if there's an individual who has done you wrong.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you, and thank you very much for being here this afternoon. Would you say more about you made a reference to how this would work against minorities coming into the profession, and could you share more about what is in your mind and what, in your experience, you're drawing on that leads you to that significant conclusion?
Well, I have grandchildren of college age. God, I hate to admit it. That sounds awful when I hear it. And to become a psychotherapist, one of them would have to give up a minimum of $50,000 in 5 years of their life. And I'm wondering, what are they going to have to charge their clients once they're in practice to get back that investment? And what kind of people can make that investment except the ones whose parents have, you know, deep pockets? And so I'm not so much, what am I trying to say? I think that it is not good for there to be very few minority therapists, few blacks, few Hispanics. I think with the population that we have, we need more participation in the professions, not less.
Okay, I appreciate your
any other further comments? Thank you very much. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Representative Peter Buckley, South Jackson County. Thank you for your time and consideration of the bill. Just to review very quickly, the bill, two primary parts. One is to make sure there's access to quality, proven, and trained professionals in the field of mental health, and the other is to make sure that consumers are protected while they partake of those services. I just wanted to very briefly discuss, with your permission, Madam Chair, the amendments that are put forth. Coming from Ashland, I have to be very supportive of the arts. My background's in the arts, and I strongly believe in the power of the arts. I don't have any problem, and I don't think that the House chair, who heard this bill, has problems with including the art therapists in the bill. One question I would have of Ledge Council, when Ledge Council comes up, whether the current definition of recreational therapy that is already in use would also cover dance, whether dance is included in recreational therapy or not. So that's a question that I would have on that. As far as the amendments you have, we are in agreement with the proponents are in agreement to try to make sure that we don't unintentionally impact individual insurance plans. If someone is self-insured and they're choosing a plan that has specific benefits, we're not trying to mandate additional benefits that they would have to add to their plan. It's simply the desire to have the licensed family and marriage therapist, licensed professional counselors receive the same sort of consideration that licensed clinical social workers do and their practitioners do when plans do cover those services. So I just want to be clear about that point. So the with the amendments that you will be looking at and wrestling with today, the only amendment that makes me not want to eat lunch today is Amendment 4, Dash 4, and that's the one that would basically gut the bill and kind of defy the...
It deletes Section 2.
Mm-hmm. So that is the one that I would hope that would not be moved forward by this... Okay.
Yes,
and Senator Morissette, and let's call Ledge Counsel Charlie Cheek up too, since we're starting to talk specifics about the amendments.
Representative, with all due respect, why do you make this bill so complicated? No, seriously. I mean, we struggled with this bill last session,
exactly.
And there were things in the bill that led it to die. You came back with what I thought was a very simple bill to be covered by group insurance,
right?
And suddenly we have all these other issues, and I don't understand it. And those are the ones that are going to kill the bill again. I'm sorry to say.
No, so. Not necessarily. Not if we have.
Well, I hope not. But,
yeah. Madam Chair and Senator Morissette, thank you. it certainly was not my intention to complicate the bill in any way, shape, or form. In fact, our intent in coming into this February session was to simplify as much as possible. We removed the requirement to add an investigator for the board so that there would not be a fiscal involved. And we took the same bill that was before you last session, and our intent was to narrow it down. The request from the other therapists was not anticipated, from dance therapists, music therapists, and art therapists was not anticipated. However, it's the feeling, at least my personal feeling, I believe the feeling of the advocates, that if it is required, if it's necessary to add these additional therapists to the bill, that we don't want to stand in the way of adding them if that is going to stop the bill.
And remember, these that we're adding, they will not be eligible for the reimbursement piece. They are added to the bill so that they will still be able to be considered mental health professionals, which they are because they're dealing with severely handicapped people or ill people.
Madam Chair, if I could just offer my agreement to that, this is in terms of the advertising their services, they would be able to continue to advertise their services, but they would not be included into the insurance panel, please.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. Given the testimony that we heard just previously from Ms. Hansen, Barbara Hansen, the proponents, and I'm looking at you now, Representative Buckley, and others are going to need to establish something on record that counters what we heard from Ms. Hansen, which was her statements. This is how I'm hearing her statement. That it's her, in her reading, in her understanding, this is a policy that will work against minorities coming into the profession. You heard that. And in my mind, as I'm hearing that, I'm thinking it would not be good to construct public policy that might work against blacks, Latinos, so-called minorities coming into the profession. So what do you say about that testimony?
Madam Chair, Senator Gorder, thank you for the opportunity to respond to that. I would assert that this bill in no way limits minority participation in any profession, whether it is a CPA, whether it's to be a college professor, whether it's to be a actor with the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. There's a certain level of expertise that must be acquired through education and through training to be considered qualified for that profession. And this bill does not address the ability for someone to enter into these professions and get the training necessary to perform these professions. There are standards in place for licensed professionals already. This doesn't change the standards for licensed professional. In order to be a licensed family and marriage therapist, this bill doesn't change those standards. It doesn't weaken them or strengthen them. For licensed professional counselors, it doesn't weaken them or strengthen them. So this bill would make no difference if it between today and tomorrow, if it passes tomorrow, in terms of the ability of a student to access our education system to acquire the training in order to join one of these professions. It would, though, it would inhibit someone coming out of a community college, for instance, and declaring themselves a counselor. And I do think, though, that's a valid policy for us to have, is to not to have people equating their ability to offer services in a way that we would not allow a doctor or dentist or someone to advertise themselves as a doctor or dentist if they did not have the training to be a doctor or dentist.
Follow up?
Yes.
Is the concern raised by Ms. Hansen one that you'd heard before? Again, as a proponent of the bill, is this something that has surfaced before and been discussed?
Madam Chair and Senator Gurley, no, it has not come up. Because, again, I would emphasize that this, it does not change the standards for the profession. It simply states who in the profession can advertise themselves in a certain manner. So it hasn't come up. It's not a point that I see as actually a valid point in terms of this bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further discussion?
All right. I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 3616. I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 3616. And how late can you stay, Dr. Drucker, before we move in? Okay, but you would have to leave at noon. Yeah. It's cutting it pretty close. I hate to. We need to get this. Unfortunately, we didn't expect to go an extra hour in session this morning when this was planned, and so I apologize profusely for you coming down. But we do know that you are coming next week. And because our committee basically will be done with House bills on Monday, hopefully we'll be able to arrange with Representative Greenlick's committee for us to participate in your. It'll be the same presentation.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I make it to Portland in 45 minutes. That gives us 50 minutes, and so we
okay.
It's pretty fast. We can do it.
All right. We'll still keep going. All right. The work session is open. And at this point in time, colleagues, we are looking at the dash threes. And the dash threes are the ones that Department of Human Services said they wanted to make sure that we would change drug and alcohol counselors to addiction.
Madam Chair.
Gambling addictions counselor.
We had this last session and we entered this. So I'd like to move proposed amendment dash one on House Bill
3.
Dash three.
Okay. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And the next amendment that we're looking at is the dash six amendments. And this will include the recreational dance, music, or art therapy.
Madam Chair, I move the dash six amendments to House Bill 36.
Okay. 16. Senator Gurley moves the dash sixes. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. And then the next amendment we're looking at is 3616, dash sevens, which actually deletes physician and psychologist. Evidently, there are independent or individual benefit plans that do not provide reimbursement to anyone but physicians or psychologists. They don't reimburse social workers. They don't, in their plans, they don't reimburse nurse practitioners. And so to meet the needs of the individual benefit plans, we will need the dash seven amendments. And did I describe that correctly, Charlie?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is correct.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move the dash 7 amendments to
Senator Gorley
House
moves
Bill 3616.
The dash 7 amendments to House Bill 3616. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3616 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves House Bill 3616 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion?
Let's have it on the floor, Madam Chair.
Senator Cruz, though, has a comment.
We have convoluted the hell out of this thing now, in my opinion. I would prefer to have a chance to have discussion in my caucus before we move it. I know it's your intention to move it. So for right now, I'm going to vote no just because I think we're moving too fast. Not that I'm opposed. It's just, you know, we started out with something relatively simple, and it's no longer that.
Further discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carter?
Are you?
Senator Cruz?
No for now.
Senator Marshall?
Yes for now.
Chair Gordley?
Aye.
And Chair Monis Anderson?
Aye. Motion carries, and I want to, for those who have the gender issue, I think this is something that we will need to address, but not this session, the following session. This bill would go, if it passes, would go into effect January 09, and hopefully between now and then we can look at some of the concerns that you have raised.
Representative, congratulations.
Thank you.
For
okay.
Now.
So motion carries, and Senator Carter, would you carry the bill?
I will.
And I will close the work session on House Bill 3616. I'd like to open an informational hearing on access to clinical trials. And I'd like to call up Dr. Brian Drucker, Christine McDonald, and Brenda Eichel. Is it Eichelberger?
Eichelberger.
All right, great. And maybe you can go first since you're
up. Well, thank you.
Welcome.
Welcome, and thank you so much for giving us the time today. It's much appreciated. My name is Brenda Eichelberger. I teach up at Portland State University. I am a CLL patient, which is a form of cancer, at OHSU. I'm also a fifth-generation Oregonian. The reason I bring that up is because my ancestors walked the Oregon Trail, and my great-great-grandfather was in the Senate in the 1860s.
Is that right?
During that time, he unfortunately contracted smallpox, took it home back to the farm. It was only because of a traveling farmhand by the name of Sam who convinced my great-great-grandmother to cut the arms of all of her children and that of the cow udder and mix the blood that it saved my family. That's because we're believers in trying things that are new, and we're believers in fighting for things that maybe can make a difference. There was a growing smallpox epidemic at that time, and my family was willing to take a chance. I see right now I'm facing my own personal epidemic, as is I think our culture, with the numbers that we're looking at with cancer and with other chronic diseases. I'm going to share with you a little bit about my process of diagnosis and my struggles in getting into a clinical trial, and then the story of a person, friend, that was not quite as fortunate as me. I went to bed just one Monday evening with a little bit of a tickle in my throat and woke up the next day with glands that were so large I was not able to breathe. I went to the doctor, and they thought it was going to be TB. They thought mono. They thought that it could be some exotic disease that I had picked up from one of my students, because I have quite a bit of foreign exchange students there, and it was in the fall. After running through quite a few tests, they determined to send me to a specialist and biopsy my lymph node, and it came back on that other side of the fence that none of us want to be on. And they said, you have cancer. The kind of cancer I have is chronic lymphocytic lymphoma. Nope, lymphocytic leukemia. So I've got lymphoma and leukemia. It's terminal. There's no cure. The treatment does not extend your life, but what it does is make it more comfortable as you go through it. My hope is for a cure, for a clinical trial. I had that opportunity, and a lifeline was thrown to me by OHSU, actually. And the trial is one of those designer vaccines that maybe you all have heard of. It's very exciting. Since the year 2000, they were able to untie the genome. And what they did was take one of my cancer cells, clone it, and through a seven-step process, splice on the edge of a keyhole limpet. And then they inject that over 16 times over a one-year period in hopes that what we're doing is rebooting my immune system. So instead of hosting the disease, it in fact recognizes it as a cancer and will fight it and contain it. So that's my hope. Now, getting into this clinical trial was what the problem was for me. Because I have double insurance. I have great insurance through Portland State University. I also have great insurance through my husband's company that he's been with for 15 or 20 years now. However, the insurance companies have an exclusion for clinical trials. What they decide to exclude or not exclude tends to be different whoever answers the other end of the telephone. So while I was reassured, my routine care costs, which are those having a chronic disease every 3 months, they have to test my blood, I have to see my physician, they have to go ahead and feel my glands, you have to have a physical exam. But once I signed for a clinical trial, it was excluded. So they excluded those costs. There was a time limit on getting the fill for this trial. So while my insurance company would say they would cover it, then they wouldn't cover it, then my secondary insurance said they would cover it, and then they wouldn't cover it, what they would give me in writing, ended up going on for actually about a period of 8 weeks until the decision had to be made, was I going into the trial or not. So currently, I am signing for personal payment of any cost that will not be covered. And I can do that because I have a good family, I have great assets, I have resources, and I'm strong and intelligent. Hopefully I can go ahead and work. Also figured I don't need my 401k if it isn't going to be that long anyway. Now, I consider myself very fortunate to have made it into this trial, but I do have stories of other people who have not. One is a woman named Judith. She was diagnosed with advanced lung cancer just about last July. Starting treatment quickly was a priority. Her preliminary care doctor referred her to OHSU, but there were no open trials, so she consulted at Providence. They had a trial. They were eager to enroll her, and she finally was ready to go. Aetna was her insurance company, bounced her around until the point where she had progressed and was getting increasing bone pain, had to go into radiation therapy, and that's what she's doing right now is radiation, even though her and her primary care physician both felt that chemo was going to be the best approach, but the delay in treatment ended up excluding her from the clinical trial that her doctor wanted to be in. We faced issues with smallpox, we faced issues with polio, we faced issues with TB. They all seemed insurmountable at the time. I think what we need to do is have people that are willing to take chances, and we need to support those people who are willing to progress with cures and assist in our diseases. And we need to support the patients, not financially hold them hostage with their insurance company. We need to support our doctors, not make them do 5, 6, 7, 8 phone calls and visits with their patients trying to fill their clinical trials. And I think we can do that. We can do that very easily. We can reduce coverage confusion. We can reduce wait times for approvals. We can increase the support of our patients and our doctors seeking the cures that will benefit us all. And we can do that through clarifying insurance coverage and increasing access to clinical trials. In fact, it's been done on the federal level for our Medicare patients and also in 24 other states. It's time that Oregon decides to do the same. I'm open for any questions.
So, well, go ahead, and then we'll ask questions.
Mine will be real brief. My name is Chris McDonald, and I'm the executive director of Susan G. Komen for the Cure in Oregon and Southwest Washington. And I'm sure many of you know about Komen, but we are an organization that's 25 years old, was founded on a promise between two sisters. Today, we have invested nearly $1 billion in the fight against breast cancer. We are committed to clinical trials. We are committed to funding research. This next year, in 2007, we are giving away $100 million for breast cancer research. Of that, I just talked yesterday to our senior science advisor in Dallas. $23 million of that will be directed towards clinical research in clinical trials. So for Komen, it's about access and ensuring quality care for everyone. So I just am here quickly. I'll let my experts talk, but Komen is absolutely committed to this issue. And on a federal level, I know we're working for it as well. So in Oregon, we think it's something that definitely needs to happen. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee. It's truly a privilege for me to be here. My name is Dr. Brian Drucker. I'm the director of the OHSU Cancer Institute. I'm an investigator of the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. Our goal in bringing this issue to you is to preview a legislative bill that we plan to introduce in the 2009 session regarding access to clinical trials. As you've heard from Brenda, this is a critically important issue. You've heard a patient's story about access to clinical trials. But let me try to explain a little bit about, first of all, a clinical trial. What's a clinical trial? Any drug that has to go through clinical trials as it's being developed before it becomes the standard of care. The life-saving medications that we currently have all go through this clinical trials process. A drug I developed called Gleevec, which is currently used for a particular type of leukemia, unfortunately not the type of leukemia that Brenda has, went through a record of the shortest clinical trial process of 3 years. And I can give you many, many examples of patients who, if they had been delayed, would not be here today. Patients who are now living 7-8 years later, living to see grandchildren, and even some great-grandchildren, and even some children of their own, because of this clinical trials process. We're not at, I should be very clear about this. This is has been looked at very, very carefully, and it does not cost insurance companies. When the National Institutes of Health have looked at their Medicare program, where you have insurance coverage for routine care, there's a no net cost of this process. When you looked at clinical trials participation in states that have enacted this type of legislation, clinical trial participation increases. What that means is it accelerates the process for drugs to go through the approval process from ideas to implementation. And by having new and better drugs on the market, it allows better therapies, patients to live longer. I should also be clear, this is not just about cancer. This is about every single drug, whether it be for diabetes, heart disease, cancer, multiple sclerosis, all the diseases that affect all the people that live and work in our state agree that we need improved access to clinical trials. When I also think, when I put my Oregon Cancer Institute director's hat on and I think about recruiting patients to our clinical trials, I need to be able to compete with other states that have this legislation. So if I have an idea that's coming out of my laboratory and I want to start a clinical trial, I may not be able to do that here because other states will have this type of legislation, or a drug company coming to me with some of their promising new drugs may look at our cancer institute and say, well, we really don't want to work with your institute because we can go to other states, California or other states that have this legislation. We don't have to worry about the enrollment. We know that we can get patients enrolled quickly in other states who are going to bypass Oregon. want to look at faculty members that I want to recruit here from prominent institutions around the country. If they come to me as a clinical researcher, meaning somebody who would run clinical trials, they may say to me, but I can go to another state that has this type of legislation. It's going to be easier for me to live and work there and get my work done. So our view is that this is something that all of us agree on across all types of disciplines, that this is the time for Oregon to look at this very carefully, modeling this on a program that already works, the Medicare program. This was reviewed last year. They agreed that the program is working, and they renewed it again for an additional 5 years because they recognize that the program is working and it's not actually costing significant amounts of money. So our hope is that in 2009 we'll be ready with legislation modeled after the Medicare legislation, something that's already working, something that clearly helps us get new and better treatments to our patients that need them today. Thank you very much.
Yes, Senator Morsette and Senator Gordon.
What opposition then is there to this bill?
We're hoping there'll be minimal.
Well, and, I mean...
Is it because of the cost?
I can't speak for the insurance industry. Yeah. I can tell you that we've met with representatives at Blue Cross Blue Shield, mm-hmm. And we've made it very clear what our intentions are. The view has been that, well, we already do this, so why do we need to legislate it? And the issue isn't perhaps with one individual insurance company. It's that we have 50 different insurance carriers in this state with five or six different policies. And some do have very clear exclusions for clinical trials. Okay. Others don't. Yeah. But my people have to sometimes make five phone calls.
Okay, good. That answers my question.
And it's a matter of efficiency.
Yeah, good. Thank you.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. First to Ms. Eichelberger, thank you so much for being here and sharing your story with us. It's so meaningful to hear what the personal impact is and on someone's life. And you used hope to describe your outlook. And I'm a praying woman, and I know that there are others up here who do the same thing, so we'll be praying for you as well. And to Dr. Drucker, it's just an honor to see you after reading about you for a long period of time, and just very honored and congratulate you on the fine work you've been doing through OHSU that benefits so many people in our world. As we talk about clinical trials, I'm also very mindful of a history that has left out women and people of color. And so would you address that? What must we do differently, perhaps, or what must we be aware of as we go forward with clinical trials in the manner in which you're describing?
Yeah, so Senator Gordon, thank you very much for your very, very kind words. And for me, it is, as I already said, it's a pleasure for me to be here. Clinical trials are a very difficult issue and something that I'm passionate about. There are many, many hurdles to participation in clinical trials, and I'm embarrassed to say that nationally, only about 3% of adults participate in clinical trials. And obviously for women and minority groups, it's even lower. Some of that has to do with access to care. Some of that has to do with attitudes about clinical trials. Much of that we need to work very, very hard, first of all, to allow access, and that's what we're hoping to do with this type of legislation. But then we also need to have a lot of work to do with education.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one area where we've looked at, for example, the accrual of women to clinical trials at our Cancer Institute, and we have a lot of work to do. We're trying to figure out what those barriers are and how we can improve the access. And as it turns out, a fair bit of it has to do with perception. Perception of risk versus benefits differs between men and women. It differs between different ethnic groups. Those are the sorts of things we need to understand. Much like my view about clinical trials is very much has been the view that I carried into drug therapy, and it was, if we understand how to attack a cancer, we can develop a drug. That's how what we did with Gleevec. Much the same with clinical trials. If we understand what the barriers are, we can do something about them. We have to have that research base that allows us to understand what we're doing. We intervene. We study what that intervention did, and then we do better. And that's our commitment at our Cancer Institute, is to try to break down these barriers. But as you can see, it's a much more complicated issue than just allowing access. It's also getting people to participate.
I appreciate your comments. And if I may follow up, Ms. McDonald, would you like to address the question?
Absolutely. Komen affiliates across the country are also encouraged. We give out what's called CRAFT grants, and that helps to recruit underserved populations to clinical trials. And here we work with our system of grantees across Oregon. We have 27. So we would be working with those groups as well to encourage participation in these activities.
Very good.
Yes, Senator Carter.
And also, would you please introduce who's...
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and students who are a member of the government class in Vancouver, Washington, and friends of my family. Sitting right next to me is Simone Bagley, who's a 3.6 GPA student and interest in math. Next to her is Natalie Haddad, who's a 3.5 student and is planning to go to college as well, with her favorite subject being English. And so I'm very, very glad to have these young women with us today.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, it's so good to see the good doctor, but I just want to say to Senator Gordley, I'm just telling the story about Dr. Drinker and Dr. Peter Kohler. So we were at this breakfast about five years ago in downtown Portland, and this man sounds very soft-spoken and everything else, but when he gets ready to get money out of your pocket, be careful. He knows how to get money out of your pocket. I mean, here I am, a working-class woman. I gave way more than I was able to give. But he is so convincing, and he is such a treasure. You are such a treasure for Oregon. Yeah. I appreciate your being here and appreciate your work, and will do anything I possibly can to help further that and to see the women that are benefiting from your work just make me even prouder. So thank you very much for being here. And Ms. Eichenberg, thank you for being here. Peggy Ross is a member of your group. I want to tell Senator Gordley that. Peggy Ross is a member of Komen, and that group is working very hard to make a difference in terms of minority and women participation.
Doing great work. Thank you.
Senator Carter, thank you. May I take that, since we're not asking for money this time, I'll take that as an invitation to come back again.
You never forget.
Thank you. Any further comments? So it looks like we're going to have legislation that's going to ensure coverage of routine costs of care associated with participation in clinical trials. So insurers out there, it'll be good for you to look at that issue and bring data back to us showing the net effect on in your industry. So thank you so very much.
Thank
we really appreciate it. I'm so glad that you were able to stay as long, and it's 8 after for
it's
you.
After
so
after.
Now don't drive too fast.
Thanks, Senator Carter.
Thank you.
And with that, we have one more issue that should take 15 to 20 minutes. Please indulge yourself if you would. I'd like to close the informational hearing on the access to clinical trials, and I'd like to open a presentation on hepatitis C, the education and outreach. Yeah. Did I open the informational?
You closed it.
And then open the informational session on hep C.
Good afternoon, committee and Madam Chair. Thank you very much for inviting me today. I feel like I'm sitting in front of a group of old friends now. I've been doing this since 2000, and I'm not going away, unlike some of my fellow advocates who would normally be here with me today. You know, they're running out of energy, so we got to change how we're doing this, and we've got to make a difference with hepatitis C. Many of you have seen Phyllis back many times sitting up here, and Phyllis is being evaluated for a liver transplant. Let's hope that everything goes smoothly for her. But, again, people are dying from hepatitis C, and we're continuing to allow ourselves to ignore this disease. And so that's why I'm here today. And I thought it was ironic yesterday as I sat down to put together my talk today, the first thing that came across my email was a Google alert. This woman, and I have a gave you guys a copy of this. This was in the Sun paper in England. This woman is the founder of the Body Shop. She was diagnosed with hepatitis C, unfortunately too late to do anything about it. And last year, a year ago yesterday, she passed away from hepatitis C. And her husband is blaming England for their lack of action. So I'm not alone sitting here today blaming our leaders for not doing anything about it. This is a worldwide problem. And we are proud to say that World Hepatitis Day will be declared for the first time ever on May 19th this year. But if it's all just talk and we don't actually move into action, nothing's going to change for hepatitis C. So for the record, I am Lauren Sant. I live at 19591 South Alberta Road in Beaver Creek, Oregon. And as many of you may know, that our organization was recently moved from Oregon City to Vancouver. That does not mean I am not an Oregonian still, though. I very much love and care for this state, and I am here as a very concerned citizen about how we're moving forward with hepatitis C. Back in 2005, it was mandated that the state come up with a plan, and I was one of the members of that committee, and we did come up with a plan. And there were about 50 people. We worked very hard. It took us a year to come up with a plan of what we should do in the state to deal with hepatitis C. And unfortunately, that plan has yet to be funded or implemented. And in the meantime, needless of many Oregonians are needlessly suffering or dying from the consequences. I want to remind you, hepatitis C is the most common chronic bloodborne infection in the United States. It is 5 times greater than HIV. 18 years since the discovery of hepatitis C, 16 years since we isolated the virus, and our public health response is still virtually non-existent. When I think back to the 80s, when people were dying of HIV and the government was slow to take action, people were needlessly dying due to fear and stigma. Why are we doing that again with the hepatitis C crisis? It is the responsibility of elected officials of the state to protect its citizens. Failure to protect citizens against the hepatitis C crisis, in my opinion, is a dereliction of duty by both the state and its leaders. Oregonians remain unknowledgeable about this disease and how to protect themselves. Hepatitis C is a silent disease. You can feel perfectly well. Most people don't know they have it. 2/3 of people don't know they have it.
Lauren, I want you to put on the record, I think, what you had shared with me. We know that hepatitis C is epidemic among meth users as well as heroin addicts. But you also said you were seeing hepatitis C in with those who are getting tattoos. And tattoos are proliferating, and there's no regulation on tattoos in this state. And so...
Absolutely, and I was just getting to that. Thank you. It is absolutely frightening. 1 in 4 adult Americans have a tattoo. A recent study that was just done, the CDC, this has been debated for years within the CDC of whether a tattoo is actually a risk factor for hepatitis C. A recent study of close to 1,900 people in the city of New York was done, and the conclusions were that all patients with tattoos need to be tested for hepatitis C. As a matter of fact, another study found that 75% of college undergraduates were putting themselves at potential risk for hepatitis C, sharing tattoos, sharing the needles, getting tattoos together, having piercing parties, sharing their piercing equipment. All of these things spread tattoos. Plus meth. We just had a meth bill on the floor a few minutes ago. The methadone crisis is truly a problem, and it is what people are coming into our substance abuse and treatment programs are coming in with meth problems, and they're coming in hepatitis C positive. So no matter who's going to pay for it, when we're going to pay for it, we're going to pay for it. It's just a matter of, do we pay for it now or later?
Senator Morse.
Lauren. I've worked on this since I came to the legislature in 1999 with fellow Speckman and so on. And there, in fact, there's a letter here from Dr. Mel Cohen from last session. And I totally support your efforts. And, you know, we will go to Ways and Means again, and we hope we can get something to get this going. It's
This is a choir.
Pardon me?
I said, yes, this is a choir.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I know.
And I passed Hep C when they were having that problem, that breakout in Jackson County. And I think it was 2000 when I passed a piece of legislation on this because our kids were just so overly exposed. And so I don't know how long she's going to have to preach about this issue. It's very, very sad commentary.
We need
tell us, get to the crux, since we know.
The crux, I think, is that we just need to fund the plan. We've got a good, solid plan.
And tell what the funding would be.
Well, the state has estimated to do a pilot project of funding the plan. The state has estimated at $367,000. That would not cover the entire plan, but it would certainly make a good start. The state of Washington just passed $400,000. To implement their state plan, and New York State is governor just recommended $1.6 million to implement their state plan. So I would imagine in a state the size of Oregon, we could get away with $400,000 and make a good dent. I mean, right now we have nothing, so anything is going to be better. And that's the obvious what we need to do. We need to make sure that the funding is there for the state plan and that DHS has the authority and the funding to take care of this issue.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Gardley.
Is there anything in the strategic plan that you are describing that addresses the prison population, particularly those who would be transitioning mm-hmm. out of prison, coming back into the community? And as you respond to that, if you know what the other states that you named are doing in their budget appropriations, that would be helpful information as well.
There is the issue is addressed in the plan as far as treatment and getting these people into care. That is not addressed in this plan. Treatment is so far beyond what any of us can imagine right now that is not addressed. However, treatment is happening in the prisons right now. As you all know, $800,000 was given in a lawsuit because we were not doing treatment in prisons. They are now treating in prisons. The problem is, as you stated, when they get out, that transitional period, so they are not eligible for treatment right now if they're going to get out within that two-year period.
Do Washington and New York address the
they are starting to. All the states are starting to do that, but because it's a separate funding stream, they're generally not programs that are integrated into the same program. Even on the national level, there is a push to get hepatitis C treatment funded in prisons because, as you know, our prisons are highly infected with hepatitis C, and even our jails. If you look at some of the numbers I gave you from Multnomah County, it's scary what is sitting in our jails. And those are people we don't have the opportunity to treat because treatment takes a year, so you have to have them captive for at least 18 months. So it's a difficult situation. They are starting to address it. I will say Oregon is doing a much better job than they used to be, but they've always typically kept those separate in legislation.
Thank you for your work and your passion.
Absolutely.
And thank you. We're needing to close up.
Yeah.
But
no.
Any closing comments?
Well,
because it's so important to keep this on the forefront, and you're doing a great job in
Well, I do want to thank you for hearing me today. You know, I will say the good news is that since I sat here last year, my brother has been cured of hepatitis C, so he no longer has hepatitis C. There is a cure for this treatment, this disease. We can make a difference. We need to make a difference, and let's not have it all on our watch that all these people die from hepatitis C, and I look forward to working with you folks in the next session, making sure we get some appropriations for DHS to be able to do their job, because they are very committed people that want to do the right thing, and I just want to support what they are doing and make sure that we can get this done in the state of Oregon. So thank you very much. I appreciate you hearing me today.
Thank you so much, Lauren. I appreciate your testimony. All right. With that, I'll close the informational session on hepatitis C. And colleagues, next Monday, we're going to have a work session on House Bill 3616. I'm not sure we're getting any more bills, but we will at least have two Well, an informational hearing on the Oregon Health Fund Board. Barney Spate will be here, as well as the Oregon Prescription Drug Program. Missy Dolan from the Oregon Prescription Drug Program will be here to speak on that. So, with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Okay.